announce Tom Daschle's replacement this morning? Aren't you glad you all came? No,
I promised that you wouldn't.
I have no earthly clue. Welcome to the Barbara Jordan Conference Center, but today, on behalf of the Kaiser Family Foundation and the American Cancer Society, we do a lot of events in this room. I see a lot of you at a lot of those events in this room, but to me personally, this is one of the more meaningful events we'll do this year, especially with the prospects of a national health reform debate still hanging in the balance. It's important to me, others may see this a little differently, but to me, because I do think that alarm bells should ring if people with cancer, significant numbers of people with cancer, are having the kinds of problems that we document in this study and in other studies that we've done, because the health insurance system should at least work for people who are very sick, and I think most people think it does. And what this study shows is that not all the time, certainly, but a lot of the time, for a variety of reasons, people with cancer fall through the cracks, and it just doesn't work as well as it should. It just does not work. We're very pleased, and I'm particularly pleased, to be doing this project in partnership with the Cancer Society. I'm pleased to be co-hosting this event with John Ceferin, the Cancer Society's CEO, who's played a real leadership role on the issues that we care about at Kaiser, health policy, and especially now, health reform. So we thank you for that. Maybe we'll do more stuff together, which would be terrific. With us also are the two co-authors of today's study, Karen Schwartz from Kaiser, who's terrific, that I can say for sure, and Christy Martin from the Cancer Society, who I assume is equally terrific, but I've just met today. That's right. Who, along with Gary Claxton from Kaiser and Christy Schmidt from the Cancer Society, are the authors of today's study. And we have also an unequaled duo of reactors here today. My longtime friend, and I'll get into that later on, Jack Rowe, and our colleague Karen Politz, both of whom I'll introduce in just a few minutes. So the plan today is pretty simple. It's some remarks from me and from John, a screening of a terrific short video, and we have the star here today who we'll introduce later, documentary based on the study, which was produced by R. Jackie Judd and Renato Perez, a summary of the findings, some commentary from Jack and from Karen, and then finally your questions, which we're delighted to have. The study of callers who called the Cancer Society call line that we're releasing today illustrates problems that many people with insurance and cancer are having in the healthcare system. What I want to do in my little introduction today is just add a little statistical context based on earlier work that we did to make the point that the kinds of problems that are illustrated, they're typical of categories of problems, but the kinds of problems that are illustrated in this study do occur in large numbers for people with cancer, and not only for people with cancer, but actually for people with serious diseases, people who are sick in our country overall. And I apologize, but for that, I need to show you a little data, which if you've watched me do this here before, I will do incredibly quickly. So it won't take long. Let me just show you a couple of charts here this morning, if this works. And yes, it does. Okay. In 2006, Molly Brody and our great polling group did a large survey of people with cancer, which we actually did with and for USA Today. And we found that, this is the point I want to make, that the kinds of problems that are highlighted in this study actually do occur in very significant numbers. And as a result of those problems, this is what you see here. Significant percentages of people told us that they or a family member with cancer, experience real financial consequences, problems like using up most or all of their savings or being contacted by a collection agency or, they just couldn't pay for basic stuff like food or heat or housing. And you can see the percentages there. You don't need me to read them to you, but at the end of the day, they add up. And so it's 1 in 3 people who told us that they or a family member experienced these kinds of consequences. And just to register a point that's important to all of us, and it's always important to us at Kaiser, in this study, we report on people with insurance and cancer. Mostly we're focusing on people with insurance and the problems that they have. So I just thought it worthwhile to register the point that people without insurance and cancer are experiencing problems. And in overwhelming numbers, these are the same consequences I just showed you a moment ago, but you can see the numbers are huge. It's 3 in 4. In today's report, we'll see a lot of things that people with cancer just didn't know about or couldn't find out about or just couldn't understand or find in the fine print of, and we all can relate to this, of their insurance policies that came back to hurt them in the end. I call them insurance surprises. And this, too, occurs in large numbers. And you can see that here. You know, my plan paid less than I expected for my medical bill. And in the end, that, too, was 1 in 3. And then finally, as someone who has had a lot of experience with this in my family and hopefully as a compassionate employer of a fair number of people, where we also deal with this as well, I just want to make the point, which I was talking with John about earlier this morning, that the insurance pressures that hit people with cancer, you know, all too often occur in the context of all kinds of other pressures that affect people with cancer as well. For example, the job pressures that you see described in this chart, particularly for people with more moderate incomes. And that's what you see here, the significant percentage who say, I had to stay in a job longer than I otherwise would have to maintain my insurance, or I was removed from a job, which isn't supposed to happen. And you see the numbers at the bottom. And then when you put all these pressures together, insurance pressures and the job pressures, of course we know that there are consequences for families overall in terms of stress. And so you see the percentages of people who told us in this survey that all of this caused someone in their household to have emotional or psychological problems. And many of us in this room have experienced this, or caused severe strain with other family members. My last point and my message today, and I think Jack may have a different perspective on this, which is fine, which is, we'll talk about it, but this is from one of our recent tracking polls, one we did in April, so it's from a different survey, and it just makes the point that it's not only people with cancer. So we do see these financial consequences, these that result from the difficulties paying for care for people who are sick generally. It may be a minority of the overall population, but it is in significant numbers, which to me is just the opposite of how you would want the healthcare system to work. You would certainly want it to work best for people who are sick. And so at the end of the day, it's 6 in 10 for people who are sick. And that's kind of my message. The system seems to be failing most where it should be working best, and that's for people who are sick. But that's my overly statistical, kind of unusual for me, introduction, and I apologize for all the numbers, but I thought that it might be useful. Before we move to the results today, we want to take a moment to bring this issue to you in a different way, through the video documentary that I mentioned, which we produced, Jackie Judd and Renato Perez produced, as a companion piece to this study. So let us bring that to you now.
For Keith Blessington, it began with stomach problems.
I was in really good shape. It was about 180, and you know, I'm 6 foot, and I had a lot of energy. And then I started getting sick with an ulcer.
The ulcer hit a far more serious problem, a tumor diagnosed as stage 3 stomach cancer. The timing could not have been worse. Keith, a tax accountant in New Hampshire, had health insurance through his employer. But in 2006, he left the company to launch a freelance business and extended his employer-based insurance through Cobra, which typically runs for 18 months. As Cobra was set to expire, Keith found a private policy and then found out he had cancer.
So as soon as I told him that, the broker said, "We can't insure you. We won't insure you. It's as simple as that." And he said, at that point, he says, "No other insurance company basically will too. You can call around." And I did call around, and all the other insurance companies said, "No, we won't insure you."
Even longtime cancer survivors face that same struggle.
He's turkey today. I see that.
Tom Olszewski, a retiree who lives in Texas, had prostate cancer and has been in remission for a decade.
Used Cobra insurance for almost a year, and then when it was about to run out, started looking for other insurances, only to find out that nobody would talk to me. Nobody even wanted to see the doctor results. You had prostate cancer. We're not talking to you.
It's a little smaller than it was before.
Yay. Jamie Drazwicki, who has health insurance through her employer in Florida, would seem to be on much more stable footing, but she's not.
I've been paying premiums my whole life. I have insurance. I have a job. Not understanding how much breast cancer, any form of cancer really costs. So I thought I was fine. I didn't understand my limits of my policy were going to kick me in the butt later on because it wasn't enough to cover my treatments.
All three of these middle-aged, middle-class people are facing the unique financial challenges that cancer can bring on, even when insured through the private health care system. Challenges ranging from finding affordable quality coverage to discovering that coverage doesn't mean protection from high out-of-pocket costs.
Come on, babe, why don't we pay?
58-year-old Jamie, who is an activities director at a nursing home and a singer by night, had a partial mastectomy in 2006, followed by chemo and radiation, and many months of breast reconstruction.
Every time I've been to a treatment, I have been battle scarred. That's what I look at it, like I'm a soldier.
Nothing to it. Okay?
In her previous job, Jamie exceeded her insurance policy's annual cap on benefits. Annual or lifetime caps sometimes don't cover a cancer patient's medical bills. Jamie managed to increase her cap threefold to $300,000 by switching to a new policy. But that also meant a larger premium, a smaller paycheck, and debt.
Okay.
Jamie's medical debt now stands at $75,000. She pays a little bit here and there, and collection agencies still call.
Well, after I yelled at them for calling me at my office at work, I said, "Lose this number. How dare you leave a message on my machine when my staff comes in to listen to my messages at times? How dare you?" I said, "Lose this number." And the woman was very genteel about it. We apologize. But they have my cell phone and they have my home phone.
Jamie says she's tried to navigate the system to get some financial aid, especially to help pay her hospital bills, but it's just too complicated.
Nobody guided me through this. I investigated my own self to get funding and help, but because I had health insurance, I could not get any grants. Yeah, I could not get any grants. I could not get any help with prescriptions. I researched as much as my little sick body would let me sit on the computer, and then I just gave up.
In Texas, Tom Olszewski is living on a fixed income that is not going nearly as far as he thought it would when he took early retirement. And a big part of the reason is the cost of health insurance. Tom ran into a problem many Americans do: insurance companies refusing to cover someone because of earlier health problems.
So if you get in at over 50 and you've had cancer, you better hope for no relapse, because it's going to be really hard to find an insurance company that wants to even deal with you.
Tom, who shows dogs as a hobby, ended up in a high-deductible plan with a health savings account. Monthly premiums are $430, and he pays almost $4,000 in medical bills before insurance takes over.
Today, approximately 25% of my family budget is used for health care. I'm just talking insurance for the budget. Yeah, if something happens and we have to go to the doctor, that's extra money that goes negative on the budget.
So he's made a risky choice for a cancer survivor, cutting back on health care because he does not want to go into debt.
I have avoided going to the doctor. I don't do annual checkups and the stuff that you're supposed to do because things are so expensive. Perish the thought I should have a heart attack or an aneurysm or some catastrophic thing that's going to put me in the hospital for a couple of weeks.
Keith Blessington has been in and out of the hospital since his diagnosis of stomach cancer, and his medical bills are mounting. When Keith's Cobra ran out, his only option was to join a high-risk pool that carries with it a monthly premium of $1,100, a $1,000 deductible, and leaves Keith responsible for 20% of his health care costs. For someone who always avoided debt, he never could have imagined the financial brink cancer has brought him to.
I'm broke right now, actually. I pay everything, but I'm running into the situation where I'm borrowing from Peter to pay Paul.
Keith has gone through his 401k. He's not paying his mortgage for a few months. He's borrowing money from a credit card to pay for 24/7 care for his ailing mother and to pay for his various medical bills.
When you have medical problems, a lot of people think it's just their doctor and the hospital. But that is not the case. There's so many other outside groups that you get bills from. You could have five different doctors or bills for one treatment that you had, and you don't even know who the other four are. But they touch base, and they submit a bill, and you don't know for sure if they will accept your insurance until they actually submit.
Keith is now $60,000 in debt, and that figure climbs an additional $6,000 every month. He's hoping that once chemo and radiation are over, he can build his strength by hiking his beloved New Hampshire hills and then find a full-time job with health insurance. But for now, he hovers between hopefulness and real despair about what cancer has done to his health and to his security.
I'm going to go down that hill, I'm going to look at my blueberries, I'm going to watch the deer around here. I'm going to make it through this, you know, I'm going to make it through it.
Okay, thank you, Jackie. Obviously, no organization has the, and that was a statistical and then a video set up for today. Obviously, no organization has the standing on this issue that the Cancer Society has. No one has the standing on this issue that John has. So I thought next that we turn to John to follow up on the video and to set us up for the summary of the study results in our panel.
Well, thank you, Drew, and thank you and the Kaiser Family Foundation for all of your great work in hosting this event, but especially for what you're doing to bring public awareness to what is a very serious issue for anyone facing cancer. And before I give my formal remarks, I'll simply say that we had a press conference 2 years ago here in Washington at the National Press Club in which I announced on behalf of the American Cancer Society that lack of access to quality health care has become a major cancer killer in America. The number is big, and it's getting worse with each passing day. You know, at the American Cancer Society, we are acutely aware that the widespread lack of access to quality and affordable health care will prevent us from what is now a reachable goal, which is eventually to eliminate suffering and death due to cancer. We've made huge progress in our understanding of this disease and our ability to prevent it, detect it early, and to cure it often. This was not true when our organization was founded. Any serious diagnosis then was a virtual death sentence, only to be preceded by a protracted period of pain and suffering. So what you're hearing about today is all the more important because it could be avoided. American Cancer Society researchers have shown the good news that quality health insurance and access to quality health care saves lives from cancer. There's 650,000 Americans alive today who would not be alive today if our death rates were the same as they were in 1991. So in addition to all the other lives we're saving 90 more lives per day than we were 15 years ago. Proof of concept that we could double and redouble that number if people had access to quality health care. So the converse of that is that we now have proven that lack of access to quality health care is a serious cause of avoidable suffering and premature death due to cancer. Women without health insurance are 2.5 times more likely to be diagnosed with late-stage breast cancer and, of course, more likely to die than women with insurance. But what is more important, because it's not perhaps a surprise to anyone, if you don't have health insurance, you're more apt to be diagnosed with an advanced stage of cancer. But what is more is patients with insurance who are diagnosed with stage 2 colon cancer have a better survival rate than uninsured patients with the less advanced stage 1 colon cancer, which one could argue virtually no one should die of. So this issue is not only a serious public health issue, it rises to a moral imperative for change. Think about it. Getting diagnosed with early stage cancer can leave an uninsured person with worse prospects, poor chances of survival, than an insured patient diagnosed with a later, more dangerous stage of the disease. Of course, health insurance must be adequate. As you heard in the video, it's not necessarily not having insurance, it's not having adequate insurance. Our best data would indicate that roughly 1 in 5 people in this room today think they have health insurance which will cover them, but if they get a diagnosis of cancer, it is inadequate. This report, which is dramatic because it simply tells the story of real people, is talking about the problem of being underinsured in this country. That is, people with insurance who, when faced with a catastrophic diagnosis, find out that their insurance fails to protect them when they need the care the most. I often ask people, professional folks, just at Harvard Business School this week, to a group of CEOs, I say, are you covered? Are you sure? How many of you know? High out-of-pocket costs coupled with a high cost of insurance premiums can force cancer patients to incur huge debt to pay for the life-saving treatment and medications they need, or, even worse, force them to delay or forego treatment altogether because of unaffordable costs. We know that 2 million cancer survivors in America today are foregoing health care that they need simply because that care is not covered and they can't afford it. As a recent study of the Kaiser Family Foundation, USA Today, and Harvard School of Public Health found, 1 in 5 cancer patients who have insurance use up all or most all of their life savings to pay for their treatment. So this report tells the stories of real people with insurance who are forced to make life or death decisions based on their inability to afford the health care that they need. The stories in this report come from the American Cancer Society's Health Insurance Assistance Service. Think about that. All the things we need to do to find better cures through research, to help people get to their treatment, to drive them there, but we have to develop and provide to the public a free service simply because so many people have health insurance problems. And so they call our national call center in Austin, Texas. This service connects the cancer patients and survivors and caregivers with health insurance specialists who work to address their needs. Now, since the American Cancer Society introduced this service in 2005, we have heard from 21,000 callers in 36 states and the District of Columbia. Sadly, we are only able to find solutions for 1 in 6 people who call today. 2 years ago, that was 1 in 5. So the problem's getting worse because adequate, affordable insurance options are so scarce for cancer patients across the country. Now, you heard from Jamie and her story, and we're fortunate to have Jamie with us today, and I wonder if, Jamie, you wouldn't stand and let us recognize your presence here today. And it's good to see you doing so well. And you heard about the fact that the hospital did forgive her of some $40,000 of that debt. But that still leaves her with a $30,000 debt. And if I could quote Jamie, she said, "You know, I stress about my bills, my job, my cancer. I get scared that I won't have enough money to buy my groceries." No one should have to choose between paying for essential health care and buying groceries. Jamie is one of 20 people profiled in this report who have bravely decided to share their stories, their all-too-real stories, so that others hopefully won't have to experience it because someone will say, this is wrong. Something's wrong with this picture. Jamie is in remission and will be undergoing breast reconstruction this summer. And so, again, we appreciate her presence here today. We have to repair our broken healthcare system so that people can access the critical care they need without risking severe financial hardship as a result of a single cancer diagnosis. Simply being covered isn't enough. The coverage has to be adequate, affordable, available when you need it, and administratively simple, and all Americans should have access to it. We also need a healthcare system that promotes good health and prevention and emphasizes quality of life throughout life. Cancer patients know firsthand the holes and gaps that exist in the broken healthcare system. If we can fix that system, many more cancer patients can not only be saved but lead normal lives. So I'm pleased to be here today, and I thank again the Kaiser Family Foundation for partnering with the American Cancer Society to bring attention to this very serious and growing problem causing needless suffering and avoidable deaths.
Wonderful. Thank you, John. I want to underscore a point that John made, which is that whether we have health reform or we don't, if you look at what's happening in the marketplace with insurance, our annual employer survey, which Gary Claxton does, we need to have a discussion in this country about what insurance is becoming and should be, the adequacy of health insurance, the point that you made. Okay, well, we've only pronounced the two of you the world's greatest researchers, so we're very happy to hear a summary of the results of the study from the two of you.
Spending to Survive profiles 20 cancer patients who are currently insured or lost their insurance as a result of their cancer diagnosis. Looking through health insurance through the cancer lens helps us clarify and understand what can be a very complex policy issue. These stories that we've compiled illustrate five key findings about the current private health insurance system and how those with cancer and others with serious disease may be exposed to the high financial burdens and at times may be unable to access the care they need. The first key finding deals with high out-of-pocket costs due to cost-sharing, caps on benefits, lifetime and annual maximums on their plan, which can leave cancer patients vulnerable to out-of-pocket costs. Patricia, who's one of the patients in the report, is a 56-year-old breast cancer patient. Her stage 2 breast cancer needed surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. However, her private insurance policy only had a $10,000 annual limit on outpatient services. Nearly all of the services she needed for her treatment were outpatient. This left Patricia with about $150,000 in medical debt and wiped out her family's savings. The second finding deals with people who depend on their employer for their health insurance and may not be protected from high health care costs when they become too sick to work. Although COBRA is available to many cancer patients who cannot continue to work, the cost of the premiums is often unaffordable for most. David is 53 and lives in North Carolina. He's a stage 4 kidney cancer patient. When he became too sick to work, he had to quit his job as a truck driver, and he and his wife decided to elect COBRA coverage to continue their health insurance. David's cashed in his 401k plan, taking a 24% loss to help cover his insurance premiums until he's eligible for Medicare. He's exhausted his retirement savings. He's living on a fixed income, and the premiums are still not enough to take care of all of his health needs. The third theme is that cancer patients and survivors are often unable to find affordable, adequate health insurance options in the individual market. Even when cancer survivors who have been in remission for years have a good long-term prognosis, they still have trouble finding coverage or are forced to pay higher health premiums because of medical underwriting. Tom, who you saw in the video, lives in Texas and is a 10-year prostate cancer survivor. He's struggling to afford his health insurance. He and his wife live on a fixed income consisting of Social Security and an individual retirement account, and about one quarter of the income goes toward paying his health insurance premiums each month. Thomas can't afford his everyday health needs, and he often delays care that he needs.
Thanks, Christy. Now moving on to the fourth key finding, which is regarding high-risk pools and why more cancer patients are not covered through these pools. High-risk pools exist in 35 states and provide a means of getting subsidized private insurance for people who would otherwise have difficulty buying private coverage because of past or current health problems. While high-risk pools do not reject people based on health status, they do typically charge higher premiums than other plans, and they can temporarily exclude pre-existing conditions. In this report, there are several people who found that high-risk pools were not a viable alternative for one of these reasons. For example, Deborah is a 52-year-old breast cancer patient from Connecticut who's on short-term disability and has had to postpone her radiation treatments after reaching her health plan's annual maximum. While she could have switched to the high-risk pool, she then would have faced a 12-month pre-existing condition exclusion and would have had to postpone her treatments even longer. And as you saw in the video, even patients such as Keith, who are covered through the high-risk pool, often struggle to pay the premiums. Keith is paying over $1,100 a month to maintain his coverage. I'll now move on to the last key finding, which focuses on limitations in the availability of public coverage. And the first issue I'd like to touch on here is the Medicare waiting period. This affects people who are receiving Social Security disability insurance because they are unable to work due to an illness or disability. People do not begin receiving this disability insurance until they have been disabled for 5 months, and they then have to wait an additional 2 years before they're eligible for Medicare. During this 2-year waiting period, people are typically living on a reduced income and may have difficulty finding and affording health insurance. One cancer patient in this report who's in the 2-year waiting period is Phyllis. She's a 6-year-old woman from Pennsylvania who's been unable to work since she was diagnosed with colon cancer. While she's receiving Social Security disability insurance, she's struggling to pay her premiums and cost sharing for her private insurance plan while she waits to become eligible for Medicare. She now has thousands of dollars in outstanding medical bills and has had to ask her son to help her with health care costs. Limitations on Medicaid eligibility also affect many cancer patients. While Medicaid is a key source of coverage for low-income children, coverage for their parents is more limited, and in 33 states, the income threshold for working parents to qualify for Medicaid is set below the poverty line, which is about $22,000 a year for a family of four. And in most states, non-disabled adults without dependent children are generally not eligible for Medicaid, regardless of their income. However, some women can qualify for Medicaid if their breast or cervical cancer was diagnosed through the CDC's screening program for low-income women. About 30,000 women are covered through this program, but others are not eligible either because their cancer was not picked up through the CDC screening program or because they've been diagnosed with another type of cancer. Because of all these limitations, no one in this report would have qualified for Medicaid, even those with low incomes, few assets, and medical debt. And now I'll turn it back to Drew, who will continue our discussion.
You caught me by surprise. I've spent a career asking analysts to quickly summarize findings, and it never happens. And it just happened. Wow. Thank you both so much. You surprised me. With concrete examples and data. Terrific. All right. Now the fun part. Jack Rowe and Karen Politz are amazingly and I would say uniquely qualified to play this role today in ways that you know from their resumes and from their reputations and so much more we won't get into today. Jack, I would say, knows absolutely everything. He ran Aetna and Mount Sinai NYU and is a distinguished physician gerontologist from my favorite hospital in the world, the Beth Israel in Boston, before it was the BI Deaconess, where he founded Harvard Medical School's Division on Aging and actually worked with my father and now is a professor at the Mailman School. And for the full scoop on Jack, I refer you to a Jackie Judd interview with Jack before a standing room audience in this room, which can be found on KaiserNetwork.org. And Karen Politz is a professor at Georgetown and its Health Policy Institute, where she directs research on health insurance and on health reform, and is probably the country's foremost expert on the individual market and on many consumer issues and health insurance. And I read every single thing that she writes, and so we're thrilled to have her as well. And we will start with, how should I put it, my old friend Jack, which does not refer to his age.
Longstanding. We do have a generational relationship because, as Drew implied, when I was training in internal medicine, what I did learn about taking care of sick patients, a lot of it I learned from Drew's father, who's a distinguished physician at Harvard Medical School. I actually think I gave the George Altman lecture once. Yeah, a very distinguished clinician. Well, thanks very much for including me. It's I get invited to things like this, and often now it's when you feel, if you're coming from the insurance industry, which I was in but not for, you're the pinata, you know. I mean, unless we got to get an insurance guy up here that we can nail on this. But nonetheless, I think it is important to get the perspective of someone with some experience with the insurance industry. I think there are two truths here. One of the truths is that there are lots of gaps in our healthcare system. We didn't need to come here this morning to learn that. But even if you're insured, there are gaps, and that's important. And you're at greatest risk for falling into one of those gaps the sicker you are and the poorer you are. And that's just truth, okay? And I think these are solid findings and good examples of what can happen to people when they fall into those gaps. So we have to fix that in some way. I think health insurance saves lives, as you indicated. The more of it you have, the more likely it is that it's going to be helpful to you. It varies a lot in its cost and its coverage. And one of the trends that we've seen over the last several years is as healthcare costs rise, the cost to the individuals rises as absolute dollars. It may not rise as a percent of the total cost, but it rises in terms of absolute dollars, and that is, for many people, a major hardship. In the report that we received, it was noted that breast cancer patients had $2,000, over $2,000 out-of-pocket expenses as a median. That's a lot of money, and for some people, that's more than they have. I'm also told that the total cost of the care for those patients was about $20,000. So there are two truths there. One is there are a lot of out-of-pocket costs. Two is 90% of the costs were covered by insurance. So it's not like those people didn't get any insurance benefit. They got a very large insurance benefit, but they still had $2,000 out-of-patient costs. And depending on which side you want to emphasize, you can say they were well-insured or they were grossly underinsured. The facts are that about 80% of the people who have employer-based health insurance in this country like it. And that was discovered during prior efforts for health care reform, which I certainly would, I'm sure Drew and I agree, is long overdue. But the employer-based system in general seems to work for most people, but it clearly wasn't working for anybody we've heard about so far today. One of the things that's important is to understand how to navigate the system, I think was the word that was used in Jamie's case. What to do when you get a diagnosis of cancer, if you have health insurance, to decrease the likelihood that you're going to fall into one of these gaps. And I want to commend the American Cancer Society and your helpline. And again, with the helpline, it depends on how you look at the data. On the one hand, only 17% of the people who called were able to have their problem resolved. On the other hand, another 57% of the people were able to make some progress. So a total of 74% of the people who called got some help. And this is not a random sample people. These are people who called the helpline because they had problems. So a lot of people who didn't have problems didn't call the helpline. So you can either say there are people falling through the gaps, or you can say, gee, an awful lot of people got help, even those who had enough trouble to make them call the helpline. But irrespective of that, here are a couple things that I think are important to keep in mind when you get a diagnosis of cancer and you are insured, things that you should do. The first thing you should do is you should take out your insurance card and turn it over and call the number on your insurance card that says, questions, help, call this number. Every insurance card has a number. And find out if your insurance company has special programs or resources that they can bring to bear for you with your problem. People don't do this often because they're afraid if I tell them I have cancer, they're going to drop me or something, which is, I'm sure, illegal. It's certainly immoral, and I don't think it happens. But you have to get past that, and you have to say, okay, I'm going to get the best care I can get within the context of the benefits that I have coming to me. Let's find out what those benefits are. And it may be many of these insurance companies have centers of excellence relationships where they have bone marrow transplants or other kinds of treatments or radiation or high-end chemotherapy or specialty pharmaceuticals or et cetera, they can have disease management programs for patients with cancer. They can get you in touch with people who know how to manage. And cancer management is very, very expensive. It's treacherous. And there are guidelines that are there. And they can help you and your doctors and your hospital keep you on the guidelines, particularly early on. When you get to stage 3 and 4 cancer, it's really tough because every patient is very different. But early on, there are established guidelines for most cancers. So that's the first thing you want to do. The second thing you want to do is you want to find out what doctors and what hospitals you can go to that are going to get covered. Don't go to a doctor who you're referred to by a friend, start getting some treatment, and find out that doctor isn't in the network of your insurance company. And when you find a doctor who is in the network, bring the book with you so when he or she wants to send you on a referral to another specialist, you can look up and say, well, here are the 5 specialists in Orlando that are covered in my insurance company. Are one of these satisfactory? Almost all the time, you're going to find a situation with major insurance companies where there's a rich network of specialists. It's very rare that there's only one person you can go to and that person isn't in the network. But you need to be proactive about this. Find out what doctors are covered. Find out what specialists are covered. Make sure the hospital has a contract. So you don't go to a doctor who wants to do an operation on you and he's in the network, but the hospital isn't. And this is hard work, and Jamie is nodding. Yes, yes. Why didn't somebody tell me this ahead of time? Right, exactly. I think it's also important to understand what medications are covered. Recently, there was an article about the fact that Medicare has decided to cover off-label use of anti-cancer drugs starting at the end of last November if they were approved in some of the compendia that are available, including the NCCN compendia. When I saw that article, knowing I was coming here, I made a couple calls to very, very large health insurance companies that I know very well to see what the story is with them, and I was pleased but not surprised to be reminded that, in fact, the insurance companies generally cover the off-label use of chemotherapeutic agents as well and have been doing so, in fact, before Medicare. So that's very helpful, and those agents are very expensive. But make sure that, because there might be 2 drugs that you could get, and one of them is covered and one isn't, and those drugs might cost $100,000 each. And your doctor may not know which one is covered for you and may, in fact, not have a preference as to which drug you get. So just make sure ahead of time, the doctors, the hospitals, the medications, the tests, the various services. Another thing you need to do is you need to understand what your expenses are likely to be. What is your copay? What is your deductible? What are the out-of-pocket maximum that you're likely to spend in a year? Ask your insurance company. They'll write it down for you. They'll tell you. They'll interpret your policy for you. Make sure you understand. And the last thing I would say, and I was very pleased to see that the hospital and Jamie were able to come to some agreement which lessened the burden that she has financially, is that everything is negotiable, that many hospitals will be willing to work with you to reduce your exposure or to provide you with a payment schedule, a no-interest payment schedule. You can, just don't give up. Work with them, and in many cases, many physicians and hospitals and other elements of the healthcare system will be able to be flexible and help you. This isn't going to solve, this doesn't close these gaps. What this does do is it prevents some people who don't need to fall into a gap from falling into one. It doesn't mean that these findings that you've heard about aren't accurate. They certainly are, and they're important, and we have to work on recommendations and ways to plug those gaps. But don't fall in a gap that you can avoid.
Terrific. We'll get more of Jack when we get to the Q&A. Karen, what do you think?
Well, push that. I think, first of all, this is a fabulous report, and I want to commend the Cancer Society and Kaiser for the report and for this gathering today. It is so important. And I want to pick up on one of Jack's themes, because I think this is important too, and it's maybe the most important lesson of this report. There is no question that health insurance is a complicated matter, that our healthcare system is a complicated matter, and that fixing it is going to be really complicated. I've only been working in that area for 25 years, so, and it's been not working for way longer than that. So there are a lot of questions that we ask about health insurance that are important questions. How much does it cost? How much can we minimize what the premium is? What's the impact going to be on federal budgets and state budgets, and how can we keep that in control? How much choice, you know, can we have? Can we have lots of different options out there, lots of different variation? How do we create incentives for doctors and patients to do the kinds of things that we want them to do? What's going to be the impact on the efficiency and the profitability of insurance markets and all the jobs that stem from that sector of our economy? What's going to be the impact on labor markets and employers and whether we can provide jobs for people in America? These are all important questions. And balancing all of them in the context of healthcare reform or even in your own personal decisions on coverage is a very difficult task. But Drew said at the outset, at a minimum, what health insurance needs to do is take care of you when you get sick. I mean, that is why we buy it, right? And if when we balance things, we get health insurance to satisfy all of those other elements of the equation, but it doesn't take care of you when you get sick, then what was the point? Health insurance is how we finance healthcare in the United States, overwhelmingly. We have a lot of coverage through public programs, but still we rely primarily on private health insurance to finance our healthcare. And we want it to do all of those other things and finance our healthcare. And I think we have to ask ourselves, can we do that? Can we do that? Health insurance does do pretty well a lot of the time. I'm a cancer survivor, too. It's been 13 years in April. And thank you. And my health insurance was actually pretty great. I don't think I paid $200 out of pocket for my cancer care. But I had my issues, too. I remember after a couple weeks after my surgery, at the beginning of my ordeal, that year, my surgery had been pre-authorized by the insurance company, and the claim statement came in, and it had been denied. It had been denied. And, you know, it turned out to be a mistake, but there I was, you know, a health policy expert. I worked for the Secretary of Health and Human Services. I was pretty wired. My husband worked for a Fortune 500 company, and I sat down on my kitchen floor and cried. I did. It's horrible to have cancer, and your ability to manage all of this other stuff when you're dealing with cancer and wondering if you're going to be here to raise your kids is just not to be underestimated. And so we need our health insurance to take care of us. And pretty good isn't good enough. 90% isn't good enough. You know, I have so many life lessons, you know, as a mother. I'm always nagging my daughter, who's an excellent student, but as she gets into the teenage years, she's, I got a 90%, Mom, it's an A. Isn't that good enough? It's not good enough. So I think what this report shows us is that we need to look at health insurance first through the lens of people who get really sick, who need their health insurance to connect them to the medical care that we know will help them and that won't leave them in a lurch, that won't leave them bankrupt, that won't leave them stressed out and sobbing on their kitchen floor. 90% is not good enough. Covering 90% of the bills for cancer treatment isn't good enough. If you owe $10,000 at the end of it, or if you owe $10,000 each year at the end of it, that's going to hurt families. Of all of the different kind of dimensions, Dr. Seffran talked about the availability of coverage, the affordability of coverage, the administrative ease of using your coverage. I just like to focus for a few minutes on the adequacy of coverage because I think that is an emerging issue in health reform and one that we should really, really keep an eye on. We have 46 million Americans who are uninsured, a crisis, a growing crisis, but we have 43 million insured Americans who are drowning in medical debt. And that number has grown 33% just since 2003. So again, as we're trying to balance all of these questions, I think we're looking for ways for health insurance to satisfy, get the premium down, don't have too much impact on jobs, blah, blah, blah. And to do that, we're kind of letting the drain out. We're letting more water out of the tub. The insurance coverage is just covering a little bit less, sometimes a lot less. You see the policies with a $10,000 annual cap. I mean, that won't even get you through your first surgery with cancer. But also just little things, you know, kind of boiling the frog to death a little bit at a time. There's a story in here about, I think, Patricia, Susan, who was going into debt from her copays. She had, looks like a really great policy, $25 copay every time you go to the doctor. She needs radiation therapy. My radiation therapy was 5 days a week for 7 weeks, $25 Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Next week, you do it again. Pretty soon, you are owed more in copays than you're paying in your premiums. And it adds up. Medical bankruptcy is overwhelmingly a problem of the insured. Half of personal bankruptcies are driven by medical debt, and 75% of those filers had health insurance. And the average, lest we think it's $100,000 bills, I mean, sometimes it is, but the average amount of medical debt that sinks a family is less than $12,000. And the slides that Drew put up at the beginning show you why. It's not just a simple equation. What percent of my, you know, you have a lot of other problems when you're seriously ill. You're depressed. You need more help at home. You maybe need help with transportation. There are many, many, many stresses on a family. And that little $12,000 little bit of extra medical debt, $1,000 a month, that can put you right over the edge, and that's what does it for families. So I think we really need to focus on the outcomes here. And these stories are a perfect barometer, a perfect metric for measuring whatever we do in our healthcare system, whether it's how we structure our high-risk pools or how we design our policies or how much we subsidize our premiums, what we think about cost sharing, how much is too much. We need to start from the perspective of somebody who's really using their insurance, somebody with cancer, somebody who's had a heart attack, somebody with diabetes, somebody who's having a baby. We need to start there and say, in this great nation, can we get the care that we need and not go broke? We can afford to do that. And so I just want to thank you. I think this lesson is elegant and simple and beautiful and easy to keep in mind, and I hope we will do that as we proceed with the very tough challenges that we're facing.
Thank you, Karen. That was an amazingly informed and powerful set of perspectives across the board, which is exactly what we strive for in events in this room. Just to lighten the mood a little, I do want to say I've never heard the expression boiling the frog to death a little bit at a time, which I plan to use. We are... I don't think you can use that if you're from Boston, which is where I'm from. But we are ready for questions, and you know our usual and magical people, I think, will travel through the room and present you with microphones. But our usual rules: would you just, you know, please tell us your name and where you're from before you ask your question? And I'm not going to say much. I want you to hear from these people who know so much about this issue. And so we're ready. So let's go.
Thank you. Danielle Alexander, I'm DC Fellow of Physicians for National Health Program. Thank you so much, Kaiser, and the American Cancer Society for this absolutely terrific report. Physicians for National Health Program absolutely have looked at this report as critical for the public health and illuminating a really serious issue for so many Americans. My question for the panel is, with the five findings that you summarized for us, single-payer national health insurance will satisfy all those, eliminating financial barriers to health, one pool for all Americans, guaranteed life, cradle-to-grave health insurance, comprehensive benefits. My question is, why do we not hear more about this policy proposal in the national healthcare debate? Do you have any insight to that? It seems to me a bit of a health policy malpractice that we don't. Thank you very much.
I said I didn't want to say much. So I'll ask Jack first if he wants to say anything. But
well, I think, you know, what this does is demonstrate in the intent of this report. This report shows the problems. It does not have a set of recommendations here. There's not a policy piece here that says, therefore, whereas A, B, C, D, E, we should do A, we should do this, that. That's a separate discussion. And this is one of the potential solutions, and there are many other potential solutions. I think this proposal has been tried and was not successfully adopted in the United States. You could ask some of the people here why it wasn't successfully adopted, but I don't think it's a new idea to have a comprehensive single-payer system. It does not seem to have been feasible politically and perhaps even financially, and there's a lot of debate going on in the White House and the Capitol Hill, as Drew and I were talking before, about whether now is the opportunity in the current economic environment or not to actually implement broad health care reform. So I think it kind of goes beyond this report. But
yeah, it's certainly a question far beyond today's study, but obviously a very strong case can be made for single payer and has been made eloquently by many over the years. We're just in an environment where solutions favored by the right or the left are, for reasons that will require a longer talk, are not going to fly at the moment, and we would be fortunate to get a more centrist but comprehensive health reform plan in the next year or so.
Let me ask you guys a question here. You know, because you each said something I thought was interesting. If we accept, and maybe I'm the only one in this room who feels this way, but let's just suspend disbelief for a minute and go with me, you know? And let's accept the fact that we can't do everything. Just for the next 5 minutes. We can't do everything. The statement was made, health insurance should take care of you when you're sick. And the echo was, health insurance should really take care of you when you're sick. And it's hard to argue with that. But one of the arguments, and I'm not taking a position here, is that if we can't do everything, and if we were going to do something more than we're doing, you wouldn't actually give everybody catastrophic coverage, which is taking care of you if you're sick. Some people say that's not the right thing to do. What we should do is give people more regular coverage. So they can go, everyone's insured. They can go to the doctor for the regular stuff, get prevention, get the vaccinations, get the well child care, you know, get things detected earlier, et cetera, et cetera. And if you can't do anything, everything, instead of building in catastrophic coverage, which is what I interpret you to say when you say take care of you when you're sick, I would think some health policy experts might on the other hand, say, no, that's not what we should do. We should do more usual care, comprehensive care, limited benefit package for everyone. So I'd be interested in your thought on that.
That is going to be someone else's thought, because I'm trying to stay out of this. Little Karen, you look like you want to say something. Okay. Good, good.
Well, that's a $64 question, and I would simply say that we have virtually no prospect of fixing the very broken healthcare system unless we put more emphasis into health promotion and prevention and the kinds of things that you, I think, Jack, you're describing as basic care. Two-thirds of all human cancer can now be prevented during a normal human lifespan. That's two-thirds of 1.4 million new cases per year. So the answer to the question is simply we need a rational healthcare system that gives people what they need when they need it, and we have to rethink heroic care, which is you should be treated for advanced disease and so forth, but at some point in time, people need to be treated with dignity in the way they want to be treated, and typically, if you ask them, that's not in intensive care.
And I'm sorry, Jack, but I can't suspend my disbelief. On this stuff, we need it both. It's not a choice. It's really not a choice. We need routine care for sure. We need much of cancer prevention. It's really just early detection, although now we have more prevention. But, you know, it's mostly finding it early. So, that's how we got this Medicaid BSEP program in the first place. What's the point of having coverage for a mammogram if you don't have coverage to get rid of the cancer once they find it? So we do need both. We need to treat people, and we absolutely need to focus much more on prevention and on public health, I might add. A lot of this effort is outside of the realm of health insurance. We need to look for ways to be healthier underlying, but you know, a lot of us are going to get cancer, right? It's 1 in 3 women and 1 in 2 men. Is that what you've taught me? We're going to get it. And we have to take care of it. We have to take care of it. And we can't lose our homes and our savings in the process of doing it. That's just, no, but this doesn't happen anywhere else on the planet in any other developed nation. It doesn't happen anywhere else. So I just don't by the premise that we have to do one or the other. Of course we can do both.
Legitimate debate. Okay, let's get more questions on the floor.
Hi, I'm Fran Kritz, and I write the Your Money, Your Health column for the LA Times. My question is for the two terrific researchers, and that is, if we were to apply Dr. Rowe's recommendations, looking at your card and calling the hospital, seeing what your copay is, staying in network, and we applied them to either the people in the story or to anyone who's going to be diagnosed with cancer this week, would it make a significant difference? And my question isn't, I don't think it would. It really is, Would it substantially or sufficiently or significantly reduce what their out-of-pocket costs would be?
Well, I think in some cases it could help. But I think, for example, with Jamie, she had a policy that had a $100,000 annual limit on benefits. So no matter what she would have done, if she would have called them, they would have just told her that. So she still would have had the high out-of-pocket cost. And another thing with Jamie is that, you know, with cancer, your body may react very differently to the different types of treatments, and so she had to try a myriad of different cocktails of chemotherapy to make hers work. And the one that ended up working for her was just really expensive. I think she told me this morning it was $52,000 a treatment. So her insurance was just inadequate, and she only had 2 options at her employer, so she chose the one that could fit into her budget. And so I think for some people it would help, but I think in people with cancer patients in Jamie's case, That wouldn't be a solution for her.
I think what it would do is it would not prevent people like Jamie from having the problem, financial problem that they develop, but it would reduce the number of people who get into that position because there are choices about what doctor to go to, what hospital to go to, which of the 2 treatments to get, et cetera. Which, if you think about them prospectively and you know what your coverage are, you can be guided by that. So I think there's no question that it would be help some people, but it's not gonna re-engineer the healthcare system. It's not gonna eliminate these gaps. It's just gonna prevent the number of people who fall into them.
Could I just add raise your hand if you have health insurance. Raise your hand if you've read your policy cover to cover.
Raise your hand if you intend to do that if you get a diagnosis of cancer.
Yeah.
There you go.
But you know what? Good luck with that. I did another project with Drew and Kaiser about a year and a half ago looking at insurance coverage for maternity care. Not nearly as complicated in most cases as cancer care. We've been having babies the same way for many, many years. And sort of what you need is pretty much the same. And it took me and my colleague, who was an attorney who's now a state insurance commissioner, months to comb through these policies and figure out how they work. They're very complicated, and they're very diverse. That, you know, health insurance is not a commodity. If you buy rice, you have rice. You know what rice is. If you have health insurance, you don't know what it is. If you read your health insurance policy and it says it covers durable medical equipment, you don't know what that means. It might be this equipment, might not be this equipment. If it says it covers, you know, experimental therapies, you don't know what those are. They're very, very complicated documents. And I think to say to people, go out and, you know, read your policy and navigate the system, well, yeah, you really should try. But I think there's also a case to be made for getting rid of some of this variation. We like to think that it promotes choice and that it promotes innovation, but it also creates a morass that you can get lost in very quickly. And we could simplify a lot of what we do by just sort of agreeing on some elements of health insurance coverage. Do you know what the definition of health insurance is, by the way, under federal law? Anything a health insurance company sells. That's the federal law definition, and we need to do a little bit better than that just so that people can have a fighting chance of understanding how their policy works and to be able to take some basic things for granted.
So having had a little experience with health insurance, let me respond. When I got to Aetna, which is, you know, it's not huge, but it was just, we had 20 million customers, $30 billion a year, health care coverage. I said, you know, I don't understand the EOB that I get every time I go to the doctor. And my wife, who's a PhD, a professor at a university in New York, didn't understand it. And I gave it to two of my daughters, both of whom have PhDs, not health policy people. One is an evolutionary biologist. The other one has a PhD in developmental psycholinguistics. And I said to them, can you read this and explain it to me? Neither one could explain it to me. Not only aren't people very literate about health care in general, this is an atypical audience, but health benefits. I mean, I was asking my family members, what's coinsurance? Define a deductible for me. What's a copayment? Clueless, right? So I said, let's change the EOB because it's the explanation of benefits. That's what it stands for. First of all, it's not an explanation because nobody understands it. And most of the ones I get, there were no benefits. So, you know, it's just zero. You must pay whatever. And so I said, explain this to me. Let's change it. And we got a huge one. We put it up on the wall of my office. And I went through every word. And I tried to change it. I said, I want to change that word. The lawyers won't let you. I want to change that word. The insurance commissioners say that you're trying to screw somebody if you do that. You have to use this word. Let's change this one. No, the federal government says you can't do that. You have to use that word. We did everything we could to try to make those things. I actually thought it was going to help me in the marketplace because if we had an EOB that people understood, they might like Aetna insurance because they a little transparency. It was in our best interest. It is in the insurance company's best interest to have you understand your benefits. But it's very, very hard, and I'm not saying anything that you're not saying about how difficult it is. I just want to make sure that you understand that the insurance companies would love to change those documents. They'd love to, because everybody complains about them, and everybody thinks that they're hiding something. It's tough to change.
Alicia Ault with the International Medical News Group. I have a question. I was struck by what Karen said about her out-of-pocket costs being $200. What has changed since that time that now we have so many people paying a lot more out-of-pocket and facing bankruptcy?
Sorry. I think we've seen an erosion in coverage for sure. We've seen increasing deductibles. We've seen increasing copays. We've seen increasing numbers of deductibles in policies. You used to just get a deductible, but now there's a hospital deductible too, and there's a drug deductible, and there may be a mental health deductible. And so now in, a lot of it is kind of scattered around in the policy. And it doesn't, any one piece of it doesn't necessarily look so bad, but if you start hitting them all every year, that will happen. Out-of-pocket limits are going up. Something we're seeing, I'm working on a follow-on project to this maternity care where we're analyzing policies, actually looking at how well they would cover cancer care and diabetes and heart attack and some other conditions. And in, I think, none of them that we're looking at, including those sold through the connector in Massachusetts, does the out-of-pocket limit actually limit all of your cost sharing?
I would agree.
Won't limit copays? Won't limit a lot of
I would say, I think there's two things that are happening that most people don't realize. One is that there is a tendency to try to get the patient's payments to be more out of pocket and less out of their salary, if you will, because the theory is that if the patient is paying at the point of care rather than in some painless way being deducted from their monthly paycheck, that maybe they'll hesitate about which drug to get or whether to go to the emergency room when they sprained their ankle or whatever. So there is a theory, and there is a lot of concern that that prevents people from getting care that they need and they should have, et cetera. But that's one of the things that's happened. The other thing you should be aware of, I think, is that this is not a trend that's only in private health insurance. Medicare has become a high deductible health plan. I mean, you know, that there is, I think, $900, $800-something hospital deductible for Medicare. I think that, is it higher than that? What is it now? It's over $1,000 hospital deductible for Medicare. So it's a high deductible health plan. So it's the federal government programs as well as the private programs have gone in that direction.
Merrill Guzner with the Center for Science and the Public Interest. It's not quite the elephant in the room, but it's certainly underlying the whole conversation that's been mentioned a couple of times, and that's the cost of cancer care. And that's driving a lot of this discussion. And what hasn't been mentioned this morning and I think deserves a little bit of attention, and to a certain extent I want to make my comment off of what Dr. Seffran said a little earlier, which was is that we're making tremendous progress. Well, in fact, over the last 20 years, we've gone from a five-year survival rate of about 50% up to about 60%. And there's a big debate in the medical literature that how much of that is actually an artifact of early detection and how much is not really greater survival. So some part of that. So clearly, we've made great progress in some areas of cancer care. And in other areas, we have not made great progress. But the point is, the question really is that, and for all the new technologies that come in, largely new drugs, the marginal cost for the increased benefit that we're getting has soared beyond all imagination. And, of course, this is, you know, commented upon all the times in the newspapers. So I guess my question is this, and then we'll have one final comment that actually plays off what Dr. Rose said, which was is that, you know, 50 to all the major costs in cancer care are in the third and fourth stage of cancer care, not in the early detection. And that's the one that really contributes, I think, to a lot of the medical bankruptcies, where in the last 15, 18 months of your life, you end up spending $10,000, $20,000 per month in healthcare system resources, both between your copay, in order to move the bell curve of survival out 4 or 5 weeks, if you look at it on a population basis. So my question is this. What we essentially have is a system that collects no data. As you alluded to earlier, we've liberalized the payment for cancer therapy tremendously in the last couple of years. Off-label uses in compendium now get listed. There was just an article in the paper last week that said that when you put it on the compendium, you know, that you can actually pay in order to get your drug listed if you're a company on the compendium, you know, to get it reviewed, and it's an off-label use. The companies can now distribute any literature they want to any doctor and any oncologist in the country with very little supervision by the FDA in order to justify the use of off-label use of cancer drugs, and we're collecting no data on the use. And your personal anecdote, I think, is a great example. If you tried many different drugs, we have no history of your usage of drugs. and your chemotherapy and how you, the knowledge that we could have gotten from your case might have been captured so that the next person might not have cost so much.
Okay.
Now, so that we know. So the question becomes,
get to an answer.
What can we do as in our reimbursement system to try to turn cancer care into a learning system?
Okay. John?
Well, let me try to be concise here. I think that CMS, under the leadership of Dr. McClellan and with the strong assistance of Sean Tunis some years ago, developed a coverage with evidence development approach, with which the speaker there was obviously, I'm sure, familiar, so that we weren't really sure whether everyone who got an implantable cardioverter defibrillator really needed it. It clearly saved lives in some cases, but there were lots of cases in which it wasn't obvious. So registries were developed, and if you get one of these, we'll pay for it, but you have to check the patient up every year, provide some data so that we have a learning healthcare system, so that it is by the very nature of its activities accruing a body of information which can be structured in a way that permits it to be interrogated to have certain kinds of important questions about efficacy and comparative effectiveness answered. And I think that approach of coverage with evidence development, which has worked, I believe, in pacemakers and in other kinds of things and various kinds of spinal implants is now being used, is an approach to some of this very expensive therapy. And not to withhold it from people until we have two more 20-year double-blind controlled trials, if there's a chance it's going to work, but at least collect the information. And so that's a strategy that I think hopefully will be implemented nationally before too long.
I've just had a couple of comments that may or may not be helpful. The point that's been made is extremely important and a serious issue that needs to be redressed. For the record, though, this year we were able to announce and document with data for the first time in over a half a century of good data that cancer incidence and mortality in both men and women for all cancers combined is going down. So there's no question about the progress, yet it is absolutely true that there are areas where we are woefully inadequate in our understanding and inability on a public basis to discuss what is rational care. And so we can say, unfortunately, that it is true that many cancer patients are undertreated, and we talked about that earlier. We can also say many cancer patients are overtreated, and we've not had a mature conversation about care for balance of life, that we need to understand when what's in the best interest of the patient is to decide. Anecdotal as it is, a medical oncologist shared with me that his own mother, who is of some substantial means, is 84 and has stage 4 colon cancer, and she chose not to take one of the new targeted therapies because of the simple cost. She could afford it, but she said, why should I spend down my assets when I know the net effect of that, we're talking about weeks or months, not years.
Would anybody on the panel like to make a final comment? You are not obligated to, but you are welcome to.
I want to push back a little bit against, just to provide some balance here, on the issue of care at the end of life. You know, I'm very sympathetic with the seeming stupidity of spending tremendous amounts of resources for very modest increments. That's one side of the argument. Everyone gets it right away. Everyone nods when you start talking about that. I've testified in the Senate Finance Committee in this. Everybody gets it. On the other side of the coin is when this argument. When I was a medical student, which was a long time ago, children with acute lymphocytic leukemia died. And then some treatments came along. They weren't very good. They were expensive. They had all kinds of side effects. They increased the average life expectancy of the kids a couple weeks or maybe a month. And then the next treatment, which was a variant of that, another month or two. And if you plot the survival over time, over the last 30 years of kids with acute lymphocytic leukemia, it didn't go sideways, and then all of a sudden the great discovery and the disease is cured. It was a gradual, incremental thing, and eventually the scientists got it right. I don't want to do anything If I were in a position in federal government, I wouldn't want to do anything to take the juice out of that innovation, out of that drive to change the molecule a little bit, find something a little better, find an additional approach. I'm impressed by what happened there to be a gradual incremental thing. So if we start putting artificial barriers that we're not going to pay for it unless it increases life expectancy by X or Y, I'm concerned what that would do. So I understand the first part of the argument completely, and I have made it. I just want everybody to understand there is another part of the argument based on the history and the experience. Breast cancer, the same thing. You look at what happened, and these are incremental improvements, not dramatic one-time improvements.
Every child was enrolled in a clinical trial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Children's oncology group
required. Okay, all right, folks. So somehow we're ending on maybe the toughest issue in healthcare, which I'm not sure is where we began, but thank you so much. Anyway, you know, in health policy and health reform, there are many days that feel like the end of life. I want to thank everybody sincerely who worked on the study and the documentary and the panel. I know that there are a lot of people in this room who have a special stake in this issue, some who declare it publicly and some who don't. I especially want to thank Jamie for being with us today. Thank you all for coming.